Hello and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast with me, Robin, and Alex, and Martin. It's all three of us together again. Like the Muppets. How are you doing, Martin?
I was going to put a Kermit voice on then for you, but it would just be awful. Everyone would be like, what are you doing? That sounds... Are you okay? You know, been away for a few weeks. What happened to your voice? So I won't do that. But no, I'm okay. Not too bad. Not too bad at all. Good to be back. Excited about discussing military blunders. I think all of us have a bit of a soft spot, a fascination in everything military. And, you know, we also have a bit of, blunders. Everyone likes to see someone fail, don't they? That's human nature. You know, you want to see people fail and laugh at it. So we can do that in today's episode.
Look at them. Look at this massive massacre that happened.
You thought that would work? Really?
Idiots. Dumbo. Oh, man. Well, yes, I'm looking forward to it. This is a good suggestion, this topic. I'm very pleased about it. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad. I was recently, I came down south, crossed the border, and I was fortunate enough to see you in the flesh, Robin.
Yeah. It was great.
Sadly, couldn't see you, of course, Martin, but it was lovely coming down south, although I think the south has given me something.
Horrible.
So apologies
in
advance if I'm coughing and phlegming everywhere. Apologies.
Thank goodness some of us this isn't in person.
Would want to collect that, Alex. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be some listeners who are very pleased to just imagine the phlegm emerging from you and contemplate what they could do with it if they had it for themselves.
That's true.
Maybe I can sell that on our Patreon page. Maybe there'll be some interest there.
It's a good tier.
Maybe it could be, yeah. Yeah.
But just interesting merchandise.
Everyone who wants to, all our wonderful Patreon supporters and YouTube members are probably more interested in the episodes of A Little More Interesting that we put up normally on a weekly basis. Last week we had a break, but there'll be more coming in the future. And we have well over 100 episodes now. In fact, we have so well over 100 episodes. I'm going to have to count again to make sure we haven't got more than 200 episodes at some point. But from as little as $1 a month, you can get access to A Little More Interesting, plus behind-the-scenes sneak peeks at some videos and early access to some of our special kind of documentary content that we make as often as we can.
And in particular, Robin, I would like to say a massive thank you to the following people. So I'd like to thank Kurt Jones, James, Still Not Bitten, Ahmed, Caleb Wilkerson, Henny Ruffle, Janie, John Baker, Nicholas Dill, The Super Show Podcast, the podcast that everyone should be listening to after this one, of course. Rashad Najjar, and then it's the big dogs. A Filthy Casual, Peas Ward, Emmett Tapia, Josh Chomatek, and Simon Workman. And of course, our wonderful YouTube member, Captain Wonky. Woo. Thank you all so, so much. You are amazing, and we love you deeply.
Before we discuss greatest military blunders, would you like to hear a riddle?
Oh, yes.
I'd love to, Robin.
Oh. Well, this riddle isn't, you'll be pleased to hear, an overlong Anglo-Saxon riddle. It's just a nice, simple one that hopefully isn't too much of a challenge for you. But hey, it's a challenge for me. So, riddle is this. Forward, I am heavy. Backward, I am not. What am I? Forward, I am heavy. Backward, I am not. What am I? So, hopefully that's a bit of a brain teaser.
Interesting.
Not rugby players, is it?
That's quite good, actually.
Okay, well, I'll have to have a think about that one,
yeah,
Robin.
Reveal the answer at the end of the episode, and hopefully it's not too challenging. But if you get it yourselves, folks, feel free to send us the answer at JinterestingYT on the platform formerly known as Twitter, as well as your thoughts on everything that we discuss in this episode. So, fellas, speaking of Twitter and users and their comments, are there any comments that you'd like to reply to from the last couple of episodes or beyond? Could be from the deep depths of history, if you wished.
Well, you know what, guys? I'll admit it right now. I didn't have a chance to listen to the last episode, which was on scary facts you never knew about sleep. So a lot of these are coming from no context, but I thought they were interesting regardless. And a lot of people responding saying that they've had sleep paralysis and exploding head syndrome. So there's a lot of people that suffer from these particular ailments. So I just wanted to read maybe one, maybe two out.
Yeah,
they
sure
are
thing.
Quite
yeah,
interesting.
That sounds fascinating.
So Alira DB4KS says, regarding the exploding head syndrome, I have a similar experience to Alex. So Alex, you know, I haven't heard about you talk about this before, so I'm interested to know. But anyway, they write, I knew it was in my head and it only lasted a second. I was mostly just annoyed because I'd almost fallen asleep. I'd almost describe it as a mental equivalent to when you jolt awake right as you're about to fall asleep. Is this like a loud bang, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my experience was a little different to that, the one I spoke about. It's for me, it was there was one instance when I was growing up and I was like a teenager. And I woke up and I swear it, my initial thought was there is a plane crashing outside our house. Like it sounded like this really like scary loud engine noise. Like, you know, like when a plane revs up to take off, it sounded like that happening. And then it just suddenly stopped after like a few seconds. Wow. But I remember like being awake and hearing it. And then it was just gone. And I went downstairs and a few people were still up and was like, did you hear that? And they were like, no. So it was really like, it shook me awake. Like,
yeah, I'm not surprised. That's crazy.
But it's interesting. Yeah. Now a few people have said they had similar experiences and it's like, for them, it was almost like that. Feeling of waking up when you've been falling. I've read that a lot. Yeah. No, it's interesting how we all experience things differently, I guess.
Absolutely.
I am grateful that it's not a recurring experience for me. It was just a one-off.
Your heart is terrifying, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. I also had a comment from that episode because we had a lot of comments on that episode and it was lots of people were telling really interesting anecdotes about their own experiences. One that I wanted to talk about was from at Michael Beale, RYA3278, who says, great episode. This is one of my favorite topics. Melatonin is sold over the counter in the US as a supplement. In the UK, it's only available by prescription. Yeah. I started taking it a few years ago, and I find it an excellent aid in falling asleep. Perhaps more interesting is how it affects dreaming. I've never used hallucinogens, but some of the dreams I've had could only be described as trippy. I've even had a dream that I was convinced was real life until I woke up, which sounds really interesting. Right. This was a chemical you described, Robin. What did this was this the chemical that induced sleeping?
Yeah,
that your brain releases.
Yeah, that's right.
And we were briefly wondering if this is like the ingredient that's used in sleeping pills.
Question answered. Apparently, so thank you. Yeah,
apparently it is. So thank you. It's probably not the same as the over the counter ones you can get over here in the UK. It sounds like you could only get it on prescription now.
Which sounds like a very British way to do things.
but it sounds really interesting. Yeah, no, I'd be curious to try that at some point. Not for like the fun of it, just for having a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
But I have a comment from Microtech 5871 on the same episode about dreams, nightmares, and sleep paralysis. And in response, I think, to Alex, you pointing out that you had been going for days without sleep. And Microtech 5871 says, 11 days without sleep. Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
How long did you have without sleep, Alex?
No, I mean, was joking. This was at the start. I said in preparation for this episode about sleep, I had gone 2 days without sleeping. I think 11 days without sleep was the world record.
The world record. Set by a schoolboy in the 1960s or something, right?
What?
It was something like that.
Clearly
a
lie.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Don't try this at home, kids. You will die.
It's scary how, or very surprising how little time that is. That do you know what I mean? Like how short that record is. You would think, like, I've never thought about it, but I'm surprised it's not longer than that someone's actually stayed up. But it's clear we need sleep. There's no way around it. We need it. Like 11 days, and even that is a very questionable record. That's the maximum that we've gone without sleep. Wow.
I think people would just die though, don't they? You know, you don't,
Your body gets exhausted. I think the scariest thing about, and this came up in the discussion, was how valuable sleep is to the brain kind of resetting itself, a bit like a computer needing to be shut down and rebooted every day. I think that's what really freaks me out, is the idea that your body, which is just a biological mechanism, needs the brain to have this refresh every day. Otherwise, it will just die because the brain will overwork itself. And I find that just seems very fragile and therefore quite disturbing. But speaking of fragile brains, we may mention a few that were bashed out in the battles that we're about to describe. So, fellas, would you like to discuss history's biggest military blunders?
Oh, more than ever.
History's biggest military blunders. We've each picked one. It might be our favourite. I know the one that I've picked, I think, is my favourite from when I was a child growing up. So I want to hear what you've got. Let's go alphabetically. Alex.
Think about that for a second.
Yeah, I did.
No, I think that's a good idea. And I think as well, mine probably is... we could go chronologically as well. Because mine is quite an old one. Oh, okay, all right. Okay, maybe not.
I can't remember which one you've gone for.
Well, I wanted to discuss the Battle of Cannae, which happened in 216 BC.
Yeah, you beat me to it, yeah.
I beat you to it, yes. Yeah. And this occurred during the Second Punic War. And it stands as one of the most renowned and studied military engagements in history. It was a pivotal clash between the Roman Republic and Carthage, led by the brilliant general
Hannibal.
Who, of course, it was Hannibal. Yes, not Hannibal the Cannibal. Hannibal Barca this battle showcased the devastating impact and strategic innovation, and had profound consequences on the broader conflict in this war. So this war was the Second Punic War, as the name would suggest, and it was a struggle for supremacy between these two Mediterranean superpowers in this day and age, Rome and Carthage. So this particular battle at Cannae occurred in the Apulian region of Italy. Hannibal's forces, significantly outnumbered by the Romans, faced the consular army commanded by Lucius Aemilius Paulus and Gaius Terentius Varro. The Roman commanders adopted a strategy of overwhelming the Carthaginians through sheer numbers, a classic tactic used to exploit their infantry's strength. However, Hannibal had something entirely different in mind. His strategy was a masterpiece of deception and maneuver. So his army was composed of infantry and cavalry drawn from various regions, and he positioned it in a crescent formation, with the center of the formation being deliberately weaker and more vulnerable looking. So I think the road, the lines of infantry were way smaller towards the center of his army, while the flanks were made stronger. And this arrangement baited the Romans to launch a frontal assault, lured by the apparent vulnerability of the Carthaginian center. As the Roman infantry pressed forward, Hannibal's center feigned retreat, creating a bulge in the Carthaginian line.
Nice.
So the Romans pushed their advantage. They pushed forward into what looked like a
classic
rout.
Classic total war tactic.
Yeah, like it. And as the Roman infantry pressed forward, Hannibal's center feigned retreat, this allowed their flanks to form a double envelopment that encircled the Romans. The Carthaginian cavalry, notably Numidians under Mahabal, excelled in isolating the Roman cavalry and preventing any hope of escape. And this resulted in a brutal encirclement that rendered the Roman forces helpless. They were hemmed in so tight, so many of them couldn't even use their swords. They're gladiators. Oh, wow. There wasn't any room.
They just crushed together.
So they went into the middle, encircled round the sides and the back, and just kind of squeezed them and killed them, of course. Wow.
Because of this, the Roman legions were unable to maneuver or employ their numerical advantage. The narrow battlefield became a death trap, with the Carthaginian infantry and cavalry systematically annihilating the Romans. Oh. Historical accounts suggest that around 50,000 Roman soldiers perished in this calamity.
What?
A staggering toll that demonstrated the ruthless efficiency of Hannibal's tactics. It also led to the deaths of one of Rome's consuls who was here in the war. So of the Roman generals and consuls who were involved in the battle, Terentius Varro fled the field of battle with the remnants of the Romans and allied cavalry. Aemilius Paulus was killed along with many other high-ranking commanders, including Gnaeus Servilius Geminus, Marcus Minucius Rufus, and other veteran patricians.
With cool names.
With cool names, yeah. Mm. Among the Roman dead were 28 of 40 tribunes, up to 80 Romans of senatorial or high magistrate rank, Ooh. And at least 200 knights, Romans of equestrian rank. 20% of Roman fighting men between the ages of 18 and 50 died at Cannae.
Wow. It's huge.
Only 14,000 Romans escaped, and 10,000 more were captured. So it's thought roughly, I think the numbers obviously vary, but it was thought that there was about, on Hannibal's side, I think about 40,000 soldiers and infantrymen and cavalry, compared with between 60 and 80,000 Romans. Right. So the Romans heavily outnumbered them, but they were cocky, they were arrogant, and they fell for what is, you know, let's just say that this mistake was studied massively from this point in history onwards, and it was something that Romans never wanted to make this mistake ever again.
Is it more of a tactical genius or a military blunder, would you say? Because it's a bit of both, isn't it? It's like the Romans shouldn't have done what they were done, but Hannibal also baited them into it.
Hannibal's tactic relies on the Romans being stupid, and the Romans' failure depends on Hannibal being clever.
Mm-hmm. I think it can only be described as a military blunder because it was so unnecessary. They were the Romans were there, heavily outnumbering them. They had every advantage available to them, and they sacrificed that. If they had just employed a little bit more caution, this could have been a very different outcome. And when the word of the defeat reached Rome, panic gripped the city. Women flocked to temples to weep for their lost husbands. Hannibal was exhorted to march on Rome, but Hannibal did not do so, famously.
But he regretted that.
Maybe that's also a military blunder on Hannibal's part.
Mm-hmm. Why did he not press the advantage?
I think he was worried that in spite of this massive victory that he just attained, maybe he was being overly cautious. I don't know.
He didn't want to then turn his success into a failure by being like, ha, we've got them on the run, lads, let's go get them. And suddenly, the wives and children have knives and they're killing us in the streets of Rome. He just didn't want to repeat that, because that's happened, and hasn't it, where what the Romans just did was get overconfidence and be like, they're running away, let's chase them. We're surrounded and we're dead. Maybe he's thinking, let's not repeat the mistake my enemy just made. Turns out to be because the Romans went on to win the Second Punic War, didn't they?
Of course, yeah. I mean, they didn't. I think either way, it kind of was a mistake for Hannibal not to push his advantage. Because in spite of this massive blow to Rome's morale and its manpower in the short term, Cannae did ultimately steal Rome's resistance for the long fight ahead. And you know, they denied Hannibal the opportunity to achieve this second victory of Cannae scale. And Hannibal, over the course of several years, saw the strength of his armies and his allies whittled away just through attrition. So maybe he should have What was it? Yeah. Crossed the mountains with his elephants and come crashing down.
Yeah.
On Rome. maybe history would have looked very different than it does today.
That's interesting, because that is kind of two blunders for the price of one there with that battle.
There you go. Yeah. Two blunders for the price of one.
Roman one, and then perhaps more importantly, Hannibal's decision after the battle.
You won the battle, but you lost the war.
Lost the war.
Yeah. Ooh. They still teach that battle in West Point and Sandhurst and places like that, don't they? Officer training
schools.
I'm sure they do.
Military history. Yeah.
Well, I think the tactic of feigning a retreat is one that's been employed countless times in any number of conflicts across the world and is almost certainly still used today as well.
Yeah. That's the lesson to be learned. It's not if I was in that class and the teacher said, "So, what lesson should we learn from this battle that are relevant to the 21st century?" I'd probably put my hand up and say, "Elephants."
Yes,
we should have more elephants in our battles.
Get some more elephants in the battle.
I mean,
don't bring your counselors, consults, and senators to the battlefield.
That too, also. Why?
They will just be killed.
This battle's going to go so well. Let's bring all of our politicians who govern our culture to the battle and send them in with the men. Let's do that. Why don't we? What a terrible idea.
You guys are saying it's a terrible idea. Maybe there'd be less war if the politicians actually had to fight it. So,
that's right.
Do you think my senators were like, "Oh, look, we're pushing them back. Let's go too. Come on, I want to go too. Come on, let's go to the front, see what's going on. We've won this battle. Let's just go and cheer on the men. They'll like us even more. They'll tell people back home, and this will help our cause in the future."
I
do wonder if there was something about that in that, wanting to be a war hero once. If you think that the battle is basically already won in your favor, then maybe you would say, I want to be on the front lines because I want to, have all the glory, especially if there's other senators there and you're all trying to make a name for yourself and be like a big hero. And then,
did you see the way they ran away? Yeah, I was here too, wasn't I? Yeah.
Good to see you. Remember me? I'm on the front lines.
And get out.
Why are they still at the sides? Why are they going around us?
So these ones here and these ones here who look really angry on horseback. What do we do about them?
Don't like that. That's the only thing. Center's looking great. Looking real good.
Really good.
Not enjoying the side so much. Oh, no, they're behind us now. Oh.
What were the orders before the battle? They go to the leader, the consul. Just like, so what's the plan? He's like, charge. Okay. And what do we do after that? Keep charging. They will retreat and we'll just charge. Okay.
Kill them?
Yeah. Okay. And what if they don't? What if they do something else? Do we just keep charging? Yeah, just charge forward. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nothing can go wrong. Okay, sure. Why not? Remember, as long as the guys at the front keep moving, they won't get crushed by the guys at the back. It's all going to be fine. All 80,000 of us, it'll be fine.
Very good.
So, thank you.
No, I thought that was a pretty important one to bring up in this discussion. And
it's a pivotal battle in world history, actually. Yeah.
Hmm.
Indeed. Well, my battle takes us a few hundred years later to China. Around AD 208, 209 is where it's estimated to have taken place. And this is the Battle of Red Cliffs. You heard of the Battle of Red Cliffs before?
Because of the John Woo movie, and that's the only reason.
Very historically accurate, I'm sure.
I believe so. I mean, I gave up when halfway through the first battle in the film, where they're flying with their swords. I'm like, I'm not sure this is historically true. But
China was kind of different. It was kind of cool back then.
They had magic powers back then. Sorry to interrupt. But
that was China's first space program. What are you talking about?
So, there are a few unknowns about, the year between 208, 209 AD, and it's believed to have been the intersection of the Yangtze and Han River near Wuhan, present-day Wuhan, but they're not sure exactly where it was. There's a little bit up to debate exactly where it was. But anyway, a bit of background about what was going on. So a warlord called Cao Cao. He had control over, very, very powerful, and had control over the Emperor Xian at the time. Apologies if I said that wrong. X-I-A-N, Xian, sounds about right. And a significant portion of northern China. And so what he wanted to do was to reunite the Han Empire, which had been fractured at this point, under his own rule. Now, there were other competing warlords, the Lui Bei and the Sun Quan, and they formed a resistance to resist Cao Cao's expansion. He wanted to go south and expand the Han Empire, and they basically wanted to resist. And so Cao Cao had over 200,000 men, so a really big army. In fact, certain estimates say it was over 500,000, but the consensus is roughly like probably around 200,000 men versus, you know, roughly a tenth of that between the Lui Bei and Sun Quan resistance. And so this, by a lot of estimates, is actually the biggest naval battle in the history of naval battles that occurred here.
Oh really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So they outnumbered them absolutely massively. But what Cao Cao did is he had a huge army of, you know, over 200,000 men, but most of them were either cavalry or infantry. And so they were getting on boats, but had no real experience in water, because of where, you know, these people were from the north, and there wasn't much need to be sailing around on boats in the north. So they didn't have much experience. And little training in, you know, naval situations as well. And so what happened basically was that the men, this huge army, suffered from seasickness at the time. And so they were stuck on all of these boats, throwing up, vomiting in a really bad way. You know, they weren't used to being on boats, let alone living on boats for months on end, which is what they were doing here. Yeah, and so what Cao Cao decided to do, or was advised to do, slash decided to do, was to chain the ships together to reduce the amount that they swayed on the water, to try and reduce the seasickness amongst the men and increase their morale. A few other things were going on at the moment, like there was certain pretty horrific sickness bugs that were going around on all the boats, and viruses, and, you know, the rest of it, dysentery, etc. And they were in a really, really bad way. And so this did the trick, like, you know, seasickness, you know, ticking that box. But the problem was that it made them sitting ducks to their enemy. And so what he did, and this actually reminds me of Game of Thrones, Alex, I know you've watched this, but what they did is they sent boats, empty boats filled with fire.
Okay.
Did this ring a bell, Alex?
Yeah.
Empty boats filled with fire. Well, actually, before then, they feigned surrender, and that's why these ships were allowed to get close. And then they emptied these ships, filled them with a whole load of fire, pushed them, these fire ships, towards the enemy fleet, which was all chained together and couldn't move. And it set the whole of the fleet ablaze with these hundreds of thousands of men on here. So the fire ships... Yeah, crashed into Cao Cao's big, you know, I guess you want to call it an armada, you could, and set it all on fire. Gosh. And so the fleet completely burnt down. But amazingly, because the fleet was like in the docks, not only did it burn all of the ships, but it also then spread to the land where the rest of his army was. It spread from there onto the docks, because it was all chained together back onto the land, and burnt decimated some of his forces on land. And so Cao Cao issued a massive retreat from where they were. But at that time of year, like, the terrain was awful, and it was basically just a huge swamp. Oh, and so thousands of men were like drowning in mud when they tried to retreat as well.
So
absolute
all round
shitstorm.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, of course, sorry, Alex, are you going to?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, it's such an interesting period of history, and it's one that, sadly, I don't really know much about. It's like the Three Kingdoms, is it?
This led to the Three Kingdoms. The Three Kingdoms started after this, and this was a big factor in that period of history.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the first times where it had been recorded of people using fire, you know, in this way to destroy ships. So it was the strategy of saying of being on these boats and then getting onto to other boats, setting them ablaze and you know, having them go downwind into Cao Cao's fleet was just a huge strike of genius, really.
Just all, like a chain reaction, dominoes for his whole army. That's just, it's kind of scary because if you're in that situation and you've got this massive, massive, massive force and you've got these basic problems to solve and you've got to be on your toes, right, and have presumably the best advisors around, someone saying, by the way, if they did this one thing, our whole army is going to get destroyed. Could we maybe not do that? Maybe we should not do it this way.
Maybe them get seasick for the time being. Be a bit safe, just in case. But then on the flip side, imagine like sending those fire ships out and you're thinking, okay, I mean, if this destroys, like realistically, if this destroys maybe a tenth of it, we'll be happy. That'll be a good success for us.
Yeah.
And then you're just slowly watching it engulf the everything.
It's like that Anchorman clip. Wow, that escalated quickly.
That escalated quickly. Yeah, what a huge wow. Was not expecting that, but I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of a lot of this history is of course written by the victors, as it famously says. So, you know, they feigned surrender and then pushed out these fire ships. Mm. And then the enemy ships happened to be tied together. I'm just thinking about kind of the order of events.
Mm.
And the feigning of surrender, like how close to, I imagine in my mind, it's that they came, you know, they came out of the woodwork, as it was, with the white flags above their heads, and then leapt off those ships onto nearby ships, and then sent them through. I imagine what the kind of the time frame was in between that. Be interesting to find out.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this is a battle that's been immortalized in Chinese history. And contributed to the division of China into those three kingdoms, as you say, the Wei province in the north, Shu in the west, and Wu in the south. So it had a direct impact on the next several hundred years of Chinese history. So pretty amazing that, you know, kids, don't tie your ships together.
Yeah.
basically. But again, it's like a combination of ingenious military tactics combined with the blunder.
From that point of view.
What were the casualties like? What do we have an estimate of how many people died?
Let's have a look. I mean, I think some of it's a little bit hazy, you know, not even knowing exactly where this happened.
Yeah, so long ago, no one really knows. Yeah.
Yeah. It just says heavy losses, but it doesn't have an exact number.
Problem with fire, burns all the remains. You can't really count.
Oh, some people have said 50,000. Oh no, that's the forces. Yeah, it's not particularly clear. It just says really high losses.
Mm.
But estimates of the army, you know, 200,000 is like an estimate of the number of men that were there, up to 800,000. Okay, this one says this. I don't know, the source of this is a bit hazy, but one of the deadliest battles in world history with at least 100,000 deaths.
Ay, ay, ay.
Wow.
So if we go by that, that's a significant portion of the army. You know?
But I can believe that, though, because if they were getting seasick on the boats, they probably couldn't swim. So everyone who...
No.
Stayed on the boat, would have burned to death, and everyone who jumped off probably drowned. And then all the men, mud can be really deadly. We see it all the time, even today, just sometimes just a sports event. If there's people get trampled in the mud, people can drown in mud. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine it was on that scale, that number of casualties. Yeah.
Mm.
Oh, shocking stuff.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. Yes. Battle of the Red Cliffs.
Yeah,
that's a really interesting one, and one that I'd never heard of before.
Yeah, I'd never, like I said, I'd only ever heard of it because of the film, but I actually don't know what happened at the battle because I never watched the whole film. So thank you, Martin. That was really interesting.
Don't bother.
Yeah, I don't feel the need now. So yeah, incredible stuff. My battle is a much smaller affair and actually probably not that historically impactful. Okay. It had an impact on one culture, I guess, because it's the Battle of the Little Bighorn, also known as Custer's Last Stand, which took place on the 25th to the 26th of June 1876 in Montana on the Crow Indian Reservation. It was part of the Great Sioux War of 1876, Sioux being another one of the Native American tribal groups, nations, I should say. So this battle is a classic case of hubris, I think, which is why it's fascinated me since I was little, because my dad was really into this period of history and had a whole collection, actually, of stuff from the Indian Wars from the late 19th century. So this is the famous Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, who led his 7th Cavalry Regiment of around 700 men to attack a group of 800 Lakota Sioux, who'd been led by Sitting Bull, you may have heard of him, off their reservation, which they'd agreed with the US government in, I think, 1868. And they'd headed towards the Little Bighorn River, which was in the Crow Reservation. So Sioux Native Americans had left their reservation illegally, in inverted commas, and gone to the Crow Reservation. And the Crow Reservation had asked the government to help expel the Sioux. Custer led his 7th Cavalry Regiment, 700 men, to take on 800 Sioux, who was actually a village of warriors, old men, women, and children. So even though they were outnumbered from the beginning by 100, it actually seemed quite easy, because half of them are women and children, and they can deal with them quite easily, right? However, Custer set off not realizing that the 800 Lakota Sioux had actually met up with other Native Americans for the Summer Buffalo Hunt, which is an annual kind of religious event that they carried out, including tribes from the Northern Cheyenne and Arapaho. So this village of 800 men and women and children that they were chasing was actually closer to 2,500.
Ooh.
Yeah, things are getting worse. And what I particularly like about this is that Custer had published several books and made a name for himself as something of an expert on Indians and how to fight them. So the fact that he completely overlooked the annual summer buffalo hunt, I feel like there's a bit of a blunder there.
I mean, he's setting himself up for a fall here, isn't he?
He really is. It gets worse. So he left on the expedition with 12 companies of cavalrymen, and he was offered by the US Army, why don't you take another 4 companies, which is 200 men, and an artillery battery of 3 cannon and 2 to 3 Gatling guns with you? And Gatling guns could fire 350 rounds per minute. Hugely destructive things, and obviously something that the Native Americans didn't have access to, let alone the cannon as well. And Custer famously refused the offer of an extra 200 men and 3 cannon and 3 Gatling guns with the line, "The 7th Cavalry can handle anything it meets."
Right.
He's already tempting fate.
Famous last words. Yeah.
So as Custer approached the now thousands of Native Americans gathered at the Little Bighorn River, his scouts warned him that there are a lot more of these than we'd initially thought.
You sure about this, Custer?
Yeah, but they hadn't actually seen the camp of the Native Americans. What they had seen was the fire coming from it, and they judged by the plumes of smoke. There's like there's way more campfires than just 800 people, and they estimated that there's at least over at least 1,100 was the figure that's been quoted and gone down to history. But Custer said, "Nah, it's fine." So he decided not to wait for reinforcements, which he had time to do because the Native Americans had no idea that he was coming. And instead, he decided to split his already small force of 700 men into 3. And he tried to do, it sounds like he tried to do what Hannibal did with the Romans. And he would lead the main force. Obviously, he had the largest section, and attack in the center. And the other two bits of his force would go around the sides in a kind of pincer movement and envelop the Native Americans and trap them. That was his plan. Mm-hmm. On the day of the attack, normally you'd send your scouts ahead just to make sure what you're up against. At this point, they hadn't even seen the camp, but he chose not to because...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because even though the scouts offered to and they said there's more of them than we think there are, he'd received a report that Native American enemy scouts had seen their army. They hadn't, by the way. This wasn't happened. They just made a mistake and they thought they'd been spotted by the Sioux. So Custer essentially panicked and said, right, we'll attack them now. Without doing any reconnaissance, we'll just go for it. He believed that by attacking quickly, he would attack the camp whilst the warriors weren't there, because he knew through his experience that the warriors would get up early and go away to hunt first thing in the morning. So he was attacking just after he thought they had gone to hunt, and he was attacking, he thought, women and children. So he believed...
Very noble of him.
I know. His plan was to capture the women and children and force the warriors to surrender when they got back from the hunt, not realizing that actually he was attacking all of the warriors with the women and children together.
So yeah. the reason for that was because they joined forces for this. So this religious...
Yes, they just met up.
He so went. They weren't going out late morning. They were hungover.
Kind of a fluke, to be honest. They just hadn't gone out that day yet.
Right.
And again, if he'd sent his scouts ahead, he would have seen that the warriors hadn't left, but he didn't.
Oh, so many opportunities to avoid this, it sounds like.
So he sent off the two flanks. He divided his army into three. He sent off the other two portions of his army to attack, and he sent them off with orders to flank them and attack straight away. And I'll attack down the middle. And to attack down the middle, I have to cross the Little Bighorn River. But for some reason that historians still haven't been able to figure out, Custer took a really big detour. So he actually arrived late. So the other two sides had attacked before he arrived make his attack. So because he attacked after the two pincers was attacked, and they were supposed to do this simultaneously, those two pincers, which were much smaller than they really needed to be to take on several thousand Indians, were repulsed straight away. In fact, one of them was routed, and they ended up retreating and joining up, and they managed to survive with heavy casualties because they teamed up, and they managed to get the baggage train with all the extra ammunition and things with them as well. So by the time Custer attacked, all of the Indians had repelled the rest of his army already, and suddenly they were like, okay, let's turn around and face this third attack. We're on you.
Yeah.
So remember that his main attack plan was to cross the river and attack the camp on the opposite side? Well, in recent years, archaeological digs have occurred, and from the evidence, it looks like Custer never even made it across the river.
Wow.
He got driven back straight away, and then his attack immediately became a defensive maneuver. So he formed a defensive position at the top of a hill, which historians agree was too small for the 300 men and horses that he had. So already his defensive position that he chose, admittedly off the hoof, so to speak, was a bad choice. He chose a bad hill to die on. he also then, evidence suggests, because the survivors on the other side of the army who had been routed came to the aftermath of this later on, and they could see that Custer had adopted a skirmish formation. Now, a skirmish formation with the cavalry at the time meant that all of the cavalrymen dismount, and one in four of the cavalrymen hold the horses. This has the effect of reducing your force by 25%, because one in every four of your men isn't able to fight because he's holding the horses. So
and probably chaos with a whole load of horses.
Exactly. You know. So instead of using his cavalry, his maneuverability to his advantage, he dismounted and then took out a quarter of his fighting force. Whilst fighting a defensive position on a hill that's too small, with also having reduced the size of his force already against a massive, massive force of Native Americans. It gets better because previous to the battle, he'd ordered all of his cavalrymen to leave their swords behind and only take a pistol and a rifle. The rifle, no bayonets either. So the only weapons they had were rifles and pistols. And the pistols were known to stop working after around 25 shots because the black powder ammunition damages the pistols. So all they had for the close quarter fighting was pistols that were guaranteed to break eventually or jam, and rifles, which, you know, they're clubs, I guess, but They're also breech loading rifles. So you fire one shot, you reload, you fire one shot, you reload, you fire one shot. So it's just a terrible, it seems like a terrible idea to leave your swords and your bayonets behind, but that's what he did. It gets worse. So in addition to being outnumbered, outmaneuvered, and outarmed, US soldiers at the time believed that if they were captured by the Sioux, they would be horribly tortured, potentially for days on end, before being killed in ritual kind of sacrifice. This isn't true, by the way. The Sioux didn't take prisoners. They just killed you outright. But because of this, there's evidence to suggest, and this was attested to by witnesses at the time, that some of Custer's men decided to commit suicide. Sorry, decided to commit suicide instead of face the prospect of being captured. So in addition to this generally terrible situation from a combat perspective, some of Custer's men are killing themselves because they think they're going to lose and get captured.
My goodness.
Wow.
So Custer and every single man of his five companies were wiped out, every single one, including Custer's two brothers, his nephew, and his brother-in-law, who had brought along as a civilian observer.
Oh my God, what?
So
just chilling out.
Total casualties have been calculated to be 268 US soldiers killed, 55 wounded, six of whom then died of their wounds, and less than 40 Native Americans killed.
Wow.
That's an epic failure.
Epic failure. And there's just a kind of icing on the cake for me. This, at the time, was very successfully spun by the white Americans into some noble kind of sacrifice by Custer and his men. You know, it's called Custer's Last Stand, and iconic image, paintings reproduced throughout history of Custer and his men surrounded by Indians, and they're fighting them off to the last round. And to be fair, the surviving Native Americans who were interviewed by historians decades later did say that all the men fought very bravely. But the evidence now suggests historians have been to the site, done some digging, and they've weighed up all the witness testimony, mostly from Native Americans, but also from the aftermath described by the US soldiers who came there at the end of the day. And it looks like there was no last stand. Custer and his men retreated to the top of the hill and were then just
demolished
by a single charge by the Native Americans, a single uphill charge, and they just died. Utter chaos straight away.
Wow.
And a lot of them looks like they were running away and fell into a ravine and died as well. So just generally a all-round fail.
You had fun in your skirmish then.
Well, I mean, he was the expert on Native American battle tactics, so nailed it. Nailed it. Well done. Yeah,
thank goodness they had him there.
I've been trying to... I haven't seen a picture of him before, but I'm just picturing... I'm just picturing him like what's his name from Blackadder 4 in the World War One one, the
Melchett
Flash.
No, oh, Flashheart. All right, yeah.
Flashheart. I was picturing him as that kind of character.
Well, I think he actually similar actually, because he's I think Custer has had a thin mustache and goatee, I think was his iconic look, and flowing blonde hair, I believe. Could be wrong about the blonde. But yeah, it's just I've always been fascinated by that battle, and actually looking it up for this episode was educational, because the last time I read anything about it was when I was reading my dad's books back in the 90s or whatever it was, and now there's more evidence to show just how spectacular a failure it was. I'm not even sure where you begin to be like, what lessons can be learned from this?
Just don't do it. Don't do this list of about a dozen things. Just don't do any of them.
Just don't do it, mate.
In fact, don't bother attacking the Native Americans.
Just leave them be.
I think more so than the other stories we've spoken about, that can definitely be said to be a military blunder as opposed to like a strategic brilliance of the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, in what was the name of your battle again, Martin?
The Red Cliffs.
The Red Cliffs. You know, the using the fire barrels, that's quite an innovative thing that not everyone might have thought to use at the time. And, you know, Hannibal definitely employed some good strategy at Cannae.
Yeah.
Whereas Custer had any number of opportunities for this not to happen, it sounded like.
Yeah. And the Sioux, the Native Americans he attacked had no idea he was there until they turned up and attacked. They would have just blissfully let them go on with their lives. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the irony, isn't it? Yeah, they would have done anything to them.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Might as well kill them if they're here.
Yeah, and they did. They did a pretty good job.
Yep.
Pretty good job. So, so yeah, thank you for listening, and thank you for sharing your examples. They are on different scales. Like Martin's, yours is huge. That's a huge disaster. But yeah, please do let us know your thoughts in the comments below on YouTube if you're watching us on YouTube, or if you're listening to us on a podcast platform of your choice, please do contact us via x.com at jinterestingyt. Or I'm at all time Robin.
I'm at all time. I'm not. I'm at Martin Interesting.
And I'm at just Alexing.
Oh, exciting, exciting. would you like to know the answer to the riddle?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I've been trying to think about it, but I can't.
It gets it's more was it heavier?
Yeah. Weighs more.
Forward, weighs more. Is it heavier?
Forward, I am heavy. Backward, I am not. What am I?
Forward, I am heavy. Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I'll give you a clue.
I am heavy. Is it to do the letters?
There's some wordplay here.
Yeah. Forward, I am heavy. What does I am? What's heavy backwards? No, it doesn't.
Forward, I am heavy. Backwards, I am not.
Oh, okay. It's going to be one.
I don't know. Go on, put us out of our misery. Unless Martin's thinking hard about it.
Oh, yeah. No, go for it.
Oh, you're so close. You're doing the right thing, just wrong end of the sentence. Not backwards is?
Turn,
which is very heavy.
Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Hope that was all right.
No, that's good.
A bit frustrating backwards, when you can't get it.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, not the best riddle in the world, I'll say that.
That's a good one.
I like that. I think that's very good. Nice wordplay.
Oh, why, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, and I hope you enjoyed that at home. If you got it, let us know, because we'll feel stupid. You know. And please do join us next time, and thank you for listening. Looking forward to telling you more tales in the next episode of Just Interesting.
Good stuff.
Ciao.
See you soon. Bye-bye.